You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Senators Cray Deeds and Bryce Reeves provided their perspectives on the 2012 legislative session and other current issues facing Virginians at Wednesday's meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The senators spoke at the Wednesday, May 9, 2012 meeting of the statesmen. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV President Sue Lieberman.
I don't think I mentioned in the first place that I'm Sue Lieberman, happy to be president of Senior Statesmen of Virginia. Welcome again. It is with great pride that I'm able to introduce Cray Deeds and Bryce Reeves, our state senators. I was going to do a long introduction of both gentlemen. What I think I will do is do that as the closing rather than the opening. We'll go alphabetically by last name. Let me just say that Cray Deeds, who is the gentleman to my far left, represents the 25th Senate District, which includes the counties of Albemarle, or part thereof, Allegheny, Bath, Highland, Nelson, and Rockbridge, and the cities of Buena Vista, Covington, Charlottesville, and Lexington. He serves on many state committees, has been awarded many honors, and in the interest of time, I'm just going to ask you to take over. About 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll do questions after. People have been writing their questions on cards, and I will read them after you finish your presentations.
Well, I really expected to have more time. I expected, you know, at least 75 minutes to talk, and I don't know how to keep, I don't know how to cut it all that short, keep it that short, but I'm honored to be back here. I'll tell you, I've been through now 21 sessions in the General Assembly, and it still gives me a thrill to think that I get to do something, I get to sit in the place, in a place designed by Thomas Jefferson, and I get to do the same kind of work that Thomas Jefferson and George Wythe and James Madison and John Tyler, lots of great Americans, great Virginians did, and it's still a thrill. Having said that, 21 sessions, this one was probably the least productive I've been through. And it's too bad for my friend Bryce Reeves that this was his first session, because there are years when we've honestly gotten things done. You know, at the beginning of every session, I like to think, what are our priorities? How can we make things happen this session to move Virginia forward? This legislative session got off to a bad start and didn't get a whole lot better. On the first, we went into the session. Last fall's election was all about jobs and all about creating economic growth and opportunity for people across Virginia. We ended up with a 20-20 tie in the Senate. Well, when we were 20-20, when the Senate was 20-20 once before, there was power sharing. And basically, things worked. In the House of Delegates, when there was a 50-50 tie, there was power sharing and things worked. 2020 this time, the day after the election, the Lieutenant Governor and the Governor said, 2020 means we have a majority. And on the first day of the legislative session, something happened that had never happened before in the Senate of Virginia. People were thrown off of committees. 2020 plus the Lieutenant Governor made an absolute majority. Yet, the Republicans, and you know, I've been here many times before, and I've appreciated your attention. I've tried to be as nonpartisan as possible, but this session was a partisan nightmare in many respects. The first day's tension really laid the foundation for the entire session. In the session, every year, there are a handful of bills that are focused on social issues, but those issues usually get out of the House of Delegates, because the good Lord knows anything comes out of the House of Delegates, and they die in committee. Well, this year they didn't. They came out on the floor and they occupied time. whether you're talking about a personhood amendment to define life at the beginning of conception, or you're talking about forcing a medical procedure on one who seeks an abortion just for the sake of embarrassing her, a mandated medical procedure. Virginia was a late night talk show laughingstock, and that was tough for all of us to go through, all of us who care about the process. In 2000, I spent 10 years in the House of Delegates, and the politics in the House of Delegates are rough and tumble. Stab them in the back, no holds barred. When I went over to the Senate in 2002, after you elected me to the state Senate in a special election, John Chichester, who was the Republican leader, came over to me after a few weeks. I was used to the politics of the House, and he said to me, "Cree, you've got the worst case of Houseitis of anybody I've ever seen. What you have to understand is that over here, meaning in the Senate, we all pull in the same direction." And what I found was that as long as John was in charge, that was true. We all worked for the common good. We worked for Virginia. Things have disintegrated badly. Even, you know, when Republicans had complete control, when Democrats had complete control, nobody was ever taken off of committees. Lots of people were taken off of committees this time. And the ugliness, instead of talking about jobs and job creation, we talked about transvaginal ultrasounds, and it embarrasses me to even talk about that in front of people. But that's what we were talking about this session. It was a tough session to get through. At the end of the day, you know, this majority, this false majority in the Senate, and I apologize to my friend Bryce Reeves for even talking about these things, but I have to if I'm going to talk honestly describe the session, at least from my perspective. This false majority could not pass a budget without a Democratic vote, and they knew that when they were elected. They could not elect judges without a Democratic vote, and they knew that when they were elected. So a 20-20 split means there's no majority. You've got to work together. That's what we've always done in Virginia. We weren't able to do that this time, and that's too bad. At the end of the day, we passed the budget. We passed a lot of bills. In my view, we've got a huge problem with VRS, unfunded liability. How big the problem is depends on your perspective. At the end of the day, under any scenario that is of the solutions, that we're gonna have an unfunded liability. It's just a question of how much we can handle. And we changed VRS in a pretty radical way. From my perspective, there are two things the retirement system does. One is it incentivizes people to work in the public sector. And two is, well, the second thing is the people that are already in the system, you have to keep their faith, keep trust with them, protect their money. What we've ensured with the changes that were pushed through the General Assembly is we've ensured that people, future employees, will have to pay more money and will get less benefit over the long haul. We kept faith, but we didn't provide the incentive for people to go into public service. We changed VRS in the long haul in a way that, you know, at least from my perspective, is probably not positive. I guess time will tell. We had to do something, and that what was done wasn't necessarily the best thing. I think we would have been better off if we had just, you know, last year we'd passed a constitutional amendment in the Senate that was killed in the House to require the General Assembly to fund VRS at the levels set by the VRS Board of Commissioners every year. If we'd done that actuarially, we would have had an end result that produced more revenue than the bills that passed this session. But that's not what we agreed to do. We changed the system forever. And that was a significant piece of legislation that passed. Another thing that passed that is a positive has to do with property rights. You know, for years we've talked about protection of property rights, and it gained popular attention back in, I guess, about 2002 or 2003 when the United States Supreme Court decided in the case, Aquilo case out of Connecticut, that it was all right to condemn property for economic development purposes. Well, people went nuts when that occurred, and many rightfully so. Eminent domain abuse is real. It occurs in some cases. It doesn't occur as frequently as some have claimed, but it occurs. And we passed a constitutional amendment. This it's going to be on the ballot this fall that I think is very important. And it says that you can't condemn property unless it's for a public purpose. You can't do it just to create jobs. You've got to protect, you know, property right is fundamental. I think I encourage everyone to take a look at that, at the language of that amendment. I think it's a positive step forward. I think, frankly, it's one of the pieces of legislation that, in my view, has done more to protect the rights of ordinary people of anything that's passed in my time in the legislature. It'll be on the ballot this fall. At the end of the day, we also, one of the biggest responsibilities we have is to pass a budget. And pass a budget, our Constitution requires that we pass a balanced budget. Well, the budget was about $87 billion, and which is the richest budget we've ever had in Virginia, and we passed it. You know, not with my vote, because we were holding out for a little more. We were trying to do a little better on some areas, and particularly on transportation, and maybe we'll have some questions about that. But at the end of the day, the budget passed, and frankly, it's better than the budget that was introduced. The budget that was introduced left gaping holes in the social safety net, would have put a lot of people in nursing homes and on Medicaid out on the street, would have cut slashed education across the board, and would have just done some things that are unacceptable. We worked together, we closed, we solved some of those problems. With transportation, we came up a little short, and over the long haul, I think that's going to cause problems for all Virginians. We'll meet next week to address some of the governor's amendments to the budget, and hopefully to elect some judges. We still have a lot of talking to do, and I'm hopeful that we can restore some dignity to the process. You know, for those of us who care about the process very deeply, what happened this past session was hurtful and was ugly and ought to bother everybody, ought to bother all Virginians. But I'm afraid that a tone was set that is going to take us to even worse places over the next few years unless we come to some resolution. I believe that there's still a Virginia way. I've always been proud of the fact that Virginia's General Assembly, unlike the Congress of the United States, is functional. We get things done. We balance the budget. We pass bills. We move Virginia forward. I'm proud that Virginia is the only state that's kept a AAA bond rating since 1938. I'm proud that Virginia's ranked the best state for business or near the top every year. I'm proud of those accolades. We ought to be focused on how to make Virginia the best place to live, the best place to work, the best place to raise kids. We shouldn't be focused on Democrats and Republicans. We can get there. Bryce. Do you want to introduce Bryce?
Sure. Thank you for staying within our time constraints. I guess that's the best way to put it. Senator Bryce Reeves represents the 17th Virginia Senate District, which includes all of Orange County and the city of Fredericksburg and parts of Albemarle, Culpeper, Louisa, and Spotsylvania counties. He serves on many Senate standing committees, and again, in the interest of time, Senator Reeves.
Thank you, Madam President. First, let me just thank everybody for coming today. I notice there's about 45 to 50 people in here, and that means a lot to show up in the middle of the day to listen to two senators tell you how session turned out. A lot of you can read that in the paper, but I think for me personally, it's just such an honor, as Cree alluded to, the first time I stepped on the Senate floor, it was kind of awe-inspiring. And then the neat thing about me being a freshman senator is I have a whole new perspective. And I will probably disagree with Cree on a few items, and there's some items that we totally agree hand in hand and would walk those bills forward. But I think this session was productive, and I think I was telling a group of high school students at Monticello just about an hour ago, one of the unique things about serving in the General Assembly is there's this thing, and I call it like mold, and it's called politics, and it attaches to everything that you do in the General Assembly. And if we could just get rid of that, and I would agree with Cree, some of that partisanship, we would be able to move a lot farther than where we are. And trying to tell our high school seniors that are graduating in Monticello the process when we talk about some of these things and how politics is involved was kind of a neat experience today. And I will tell you that the Commonwealth of Virginia is in good shape. We have some great leaders coming out of the high school, and I'll tell you, it was very encouraging to see their faces, to listen to their questions, and they don't hold anything back, and they give it to you straight, and I appreciated it. You know, we introduced almost 2,800 bills this year. For a new guy, there's no training to be a state senator, so you learn from lions in the Senate like Cree and how they do some things. And I will tell you, as much as the political banter has been going out, the Senate by and large is a pretty civil place, and we get along very well actually in the Senate. And I know that any time that I'm down there, if I have a question, I can walk in his door and he's going to give me the straight answer on some of these things and how to do it. And and I have worked to build some great relationships down there on the other side of the aisle. It's kind of like herding cats sometimes, I think. But, you know, we had a lot of money, and we still have to shake some of these things out. And I brought some facts and figures on some different things with public education, health and human resources got funded. And Cree is right on some of these things. You know, each party is guilty of being short-sighted in certain areas. And that's what's great about the collective group is we get all down there and we say, hey, this is the budget we need to have, and it's a process. And it's called compromise. And it's called, you know, no one wants their ox gored. No one wants any less of anything. But the bottom line is at the end of the day, at the end of the 60-day cycle, as things trickle down and things get allocated, everybody's fighting for their piece of the pie, and, you know, I think we do a pretty good job at making sure that those vital resources, those safety nets are in place and to help those folks. And so maybe the political discourse was probably pretty rough this year, but, you know, I think Obama said it best when he said elections have consequences. I defeated Ed Hauck, a 28-year incumbent, and, you know, I will always remember this, and I've said it before. I have the greatest respect for Senator Hauck because on election night he gave me probably the best piece of advice I'll ever keep as long as I'm in political office, and that is take care of your family, because the Senate will take everything you have to include your family if you let it. And so I've always tried to keep that in the back of my brain. And it just shows you the type of folks that come out and that lead in the Senate. And I'm happy to be able to call Senator Deeds a friend, because he truly is a friend when we go to work on issues. We might not always agree, but at the end of the day, we can go have dinner, we can do some of those things, and we can work on those issues. I think Monday we go back, 1 o'clock. I asked the governor's staff today how many amendments are we looking at, and it seems to be a buildup right before you go back in, the amount of emails we get, everybody trying to, again, get their piece of the pie. But and we fell short. We did fall short on transportation, and it's an issue that I think we absolutely at some point need to get down and really address true solutions for that. I don't happen to serve on that committee. I serve on courts of justice, general laws and regs, or technologies, social services and rehabilitation, and privileges and elections. I think I serve on two with you. Is that right? Two, P&E, and I think one more, but yeah, general laws. But as senators, we have a lot to do if you really think about it. I was surprised. Most of the delegates serve on two, three committees. We serve on four standing committees plus all the other additional duties that we have, and we still have the same staffing power, which I still haven't figured out with the amount of people that we represent as senators, 204,000 people. We do it all with one staff person. So if for some reason you call either of our offices and we don't get back to you right away, it's probably because our staff is probably losing hair. But let me just say this. Your governor's working very, very hard for you. I saw the governor yesterday. He's out, and I think we as a Senate and we as a body understand where Virginia is, and we still are the best managed state in the Union. We're number one for jobs, and we're number one for growth. And I think as long as we can continue to get our budgets passed and balance our budgets, I think we'll stay in pretty good shape, and I think we'll be able to continue to move Virginia forward. I look forward to spending time with Cree on some of the bigger issues and really hashing these things out. And, you know, I would like you all to keep a great perspective in your head of this picture, really of this table, and there's two ends to this table. And when you serve in any body, there's going to be folks on this end of the table and that end of the table. And at the end of the day, you all wind up like these cups and glasses, because that's the way you're going to move the table forward. And so I think that's where we are as a body, trying to figure some of this stuff out. It's not a perfect, it's not perfect in any stretch or design of the imagination, but it does function. And I think it functioned very well. I think we definitely function a lot better than the House, but that's my own perspective from a freshman point of view. So with that, I'd be happy to turn it back over to Madam President.
Thank you. We do have some questions, and if anyone else has questions to submit, please give them to Bill Davis here, and we will present them to the senators. This question is addressed to both of you. What structural changes would you advocate to address the problems at the at legislative gridlock?
You know, that's a very good question, but the structure we've got in place has essentially been in place since the 1780s or 1790s. It's worked pretty well for a long time. I don't know that we need structural change. I just think we need attitude change, perhaps attitude adjustment. But I'm not at this point willing to advocate for longer for changes such as I guess structure you're talking about. You know, we could be a unicameral legislature like Nebraska. We could just vote to do away with the House of Delegates. That might be a pretty good idea.
Rob Bell's in the back.
Is Rob Bell in the back?
No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. under the Constitution, we don't have to change the Constitution. We could go from 40 Senate districts to 33 Senate districts. We could go from 100 House districts to 90 House districts. We might figure out which 7 senators we want to knock off and which 10 delegates and just not eliminate their districts. I mean, but honestly, and that all joking aside, I don't know of structural changes that will fix what the problems we've had recently. There just need to be some attitude changes. Compromise, Bryce is exactly right. Compromise is what politics is all about. We have to work together. I just think there's too much partisanship in the process. I've served 10 years in the House, now 11 years in the Senate. I see... formerly, great differences between the House and the Senate. I don't see the difference now. I don't see the difference between the House and the Senate. I used to see great differences between what happened in Washington and what appears to happen in Washington, at least from my vantage point in Millborough Springs, and what happens in Richmond. I see the lines there blurring too, and that doesn't make me happy. But I don't know that structural changes will fix that overnight.
I'm just wondering, whoever gave that question, are you talking about maybe a two-term opportunity for the governor to serve or anything like that? Now, structural changes, if you're talking about the rules of the Senate, that we vote on those at the beginning of session each time, and those are set up from the Rules Committee that's made up of – are you on rules?
No.
I don't know. We all serve so many different places and go different directions all the time. But that might be an area that you could even look at. But, you know, I truly do. I think it functions really well, you know, especially on the committee level. I think there's a lot of bright folks in the Senate, you know. And he's an attorney. I'm not. I was a former law enforcement, and I'm on courts of justice, and I think I bring a different perspective to the courts of justice from a law enforcement perspective. So, you know, and it's amazing. We have Dr. Ralph Northam, who is a pediatric neurologist. So when it comes to some of these issues with regards to medicine and all those things and the actual practical application of some of that stuff, he's our resident expert. So we draw a lot on each other regardless of party because of what we use as our experience. And so I think I don't I don't see that we really truly need that. I think what we need is some folks willing to sit down at a table like this and not beat each other over the head and really address some of your questions without putting that mold of politics on there.
Let me, if I can, just talk about a couple of things. One is, we're talking about lawyers in the legislature. It's very popular for people to say there are too many lawyers in politics. I mean, how many believe that? How many believe there are too many lawyers in the General Assembly? Okay, there may have been a time. There may have been a time when the majority of people in the legislature were lawyers. When I got to the House of Delegates, there were 42 lawyers out of 100. Now there are 23. There are 13 lawyers in the Senate, so 36 out of 140. You know, you want a variety of people. You want to, and they all, as Bryce said, they all bring different perspectives, and that's valuable. That to have somebody who's actually walked a beat as a police officer, to have Ralph Northam who has actually examined a child's brain, that's invaluable experience. But you also want lawyers. You want people that have read the law. You want people that know how laws are interpreted in court. And I would suggest that when you don't have lawyers in the General Assembly, you empower two things: the permanent government, the legislative staff, and the lawyers in the different agencies that interpret the law, and lobbyists. You empower lobbyists, a lot of whom are lawyers.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply that we don't need lawyers in there. I wasn't saying that. But he's absolutely right, and I'll give you a prime case. Sitting on courts of justice, I sit between two attorneys, and both of them are on different spectrums of one's a prosecutor, one's a defense attorney. But when we talk to actual, the verbiage on a law changing a shall to a may or an or to an and, those things that are actual working documents of how the law should read, I didn't go to law school. And so I always lean on those colleagues to ask them on specifics about the law. And so you're absolutely right, Cree. And you got to have them here because they understand the law constitutionally as well. So,
and the second thing I wanted to make was about a structural issue that's popular that a lot of people talk about, and that's the two-term governorship. And in general, there's a lot to be said for having a governor having two terms, being able to make long-term plans. But think about it this way. A governor who doesn't have to run for re-election, who isn't looking for the next office, can lead. You know, and I'd suggest that if you look in your community, Jerry Blaus was the last governor who spent 4 years working hard to move Virginia forward and making a great accomplishment. And that was the last political office he sought and the last he held. I mean, one term as governor can be a force for a lot of progress. So I'm not even sure if that structural change is one that we need. I think that that might be a place where Virginia being unique among the 50 states, having the only governor who serves one term, is enough. I mean, I don't know that we need to change that.
Okay. Moving right along. Both of you, please respond. With a projected VOD allocation of $500 million between now and 2040, how can Virginia justify spending half of that amount, $250, on 16.2 miles of the Western Bypass within the next 6 years, leaving only $250 for the next 22 years?
VOD. VDOT.
VDOT.
Okay.
Yeah, VDOT.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay. The General Assembly really doesn't decide which projects get built. We decide how the money's raised for transportation. And then you've got metropolitan planning districts, metropolitan planning organizations, MPOs, and the Commonwealth Transportation Board that decide which projects are built. Now, the transportation is such a deep issue, and we can spend a lot of time talking about it. The bypass was designed 30-some years ago. It's a 6.2 mile stretch that doesn't bypass everything today. And it really is just an extension. It doesn't do what it was designed to do 30-some years ago. And it was always estimated to be a $340-350 million project. Well, last year, the governor and Secretary of Transportation and I guess the MPO, ultimately, and then the Commonwealth Transportation Board decided to fund the project to the tune of $200 million. And that's what will happen. It will be built. But that's not a decision that the General Assembly made. Now, here's the thing to think about. Construction projects that are going on in Virginia today aren't being built with cash we've raised. They're being built with cash we've borrowed. We borrowed. When Tim Kaine was governor, a lot of transportation bonds were authorized. They were never issued because it's responsible to have the money in the bank or have a plan for raising the money to pay off the debt. And that the bonds were never authorized. Well, last year, I didn't vote for it, but another bond package passed for transportation projects. And the plan is amorphous as to how they're going to be paid, but that's how the bypass is being built. It's being built with borrowed money. That's how lots of transportation projects are being built. And they're not, let me just say, there are a couple of projects that are being built in Virginia, not with borrowed money, but with tolls. And that's an issue as well. But you know, the issue is where the money goes is not a decision issue that we that Bryce Reeves and I are going to decide. It's going to be decided ultimately by the Commonwealth Transportation Board. The issue of where the money comes from, it's up to us. And this is the task we failed miserably for a long time, long before Bryce got there, but we've continued to fail it. And that's to provide a long-term plan for transportation funding. We've got a deficit. We've got a maintenance deficit in the billions of dollars. We've got bridges and tunnels statewide that are structurally deficient. About 40% of our bridges and tunnels are structurally deficient. We've got huge needs, and we are basically going to be broke when we run out of this borrowed money. And that's going to be about 2017. The borrowed money is going to be spent by 2016. We're going to be broke with cash and borrowed money by 2017. But we're still going to be paying the debt back in 2038.
I would agree with what Cree is saying, that we have some major issues, and we are using borrowed money. The governor, I think, was pretty smart in going to get our Garvey bonds refinanced and looking for revenue sources. And some of that is through tolls, and that was one of the hiccups on the budget. Thank you. Was toll abatement, and how do we do that for the 11.5-mile stretch for the Dulles Toll Road out to the airport, which, you know, can certainly has an impact on Northern Virginia and those folks, but it doesn't do a lot for us down here unless we're driving to Dulles or using that. So. You know, we're one Commonwealth, and we need one plan that's going to address that, and we haven't got it done. There's no denying that we haven't solved transportation, and I don't think anybody has the magic bullet, but the reality is some of the proposals the governor has put forward haven't made it through, and I think Frank Wagner had a plan, Senator Wagner, this year to index the gas tax that made it through the Senate. It died in the House. If Governor Blyles would have added indexing way back when he was governor, that would have solved a lot of issues.
Even now, right.
And so it's just trying to really honestly sit down and figure out how we do it. These are such big numbers. I mean, they're huge numbers, and it's not just about transportation. You're talking about education and all the other things that have to go along with that, and there's just so much money to go around. And so until you're driving your SUV and it falls into a pothole and you've had enough, then we're going to get there. We can't even lock up the transportation budget because we can't get that through. So there are a lot of things that we do well, and there's some things that are really going to start to affect us, and roads is one of them. You know, and I don't have that solution. If I did, I'd probably be governor.
Which brings us to another question. How in the world are we going to solve transportation and education issues and problems without raising taxes?
Well, I'll start first on this one. I, as a small business owner, let me just say, one of the hardest things I have to do is write that check to the IRS all the time and put away quarterly taxes. So as a small business owner, I really understand how taxes affect us in hiring decisions, some of those things. Are we going to be able to raise the funds for transportation without raising taxes? I don't know. I don't know that answer. I was pleased to see that indexing got through the Senate because it is a chip away at where we need to be. You know, the governors had some ideas that would go through. They tried to take a percentage of the monies from the sales tax, some other things, and it just hasn't done it. And until Virginians get together and say, we've had enough of this and we're going to try to do it, I don't think we're going to get it done.
Well, I mean, I guess I've had several million dollars spent against me over the years because I voted to raise the gas tax a couple times. Honestly, here's the reality. If you want things, you have to pay for them. If you want a transportation system that works, you got to pay for it. You know, I believe in general, and this is a generality, the state government has to do two things really well, and everything else will work if they do those things. One, it has to provide the intellectual infrastructure for economic opportunity, for growth, and that's education, K-12 and higher education. And two, it has to provide the transportation infrastructure for economic growth. Now, what Harry Byrd did in the 1920s, I mean, it wouldn't happen today. Nobody's got the guts to do this today. In the 1920s, he started the Virginia Department of Highways, and you know what? He started it with a 3 cent gas tax. And that was the first step and the most important step in the first half of the 20th century towards modernizing Virginia's economy. The second most important step in the 20th century came from something else that wouldn't happen if you depended on the leadership that we have today. We wouldn't have the guts to do this. Mills Godwin, in 1966, created the community college system and paid for that with a 3% sales tax. We wouldn't have the guts to do that today. But with that, he put a college education within the grasp of every single person. Sometimes when you do things, you got to pay for them. Now, can we fix education without raising taxes? Yes, we can. I think if we fix transportation, we free up. I mean, some of the ideas that the governor advanced this time, taking a percentage of the sales tax, doing this, doing that, that's robbing Peter to pay Paul. Those dollars today go into the general fund of public safety, public health, public education, K-12, and public higher education. You know, to take anything from that pot of money for transportation creates a bleed that will not stop. It will continue to erode the basis for funding general fund obligations. It's just a bad idea, and I'm not going to support that. Can you fund transportation without raising taxes somehow? You don't have to call it a tax, I guess. In the last few years, it's been very popular to raise every daggone fee, and anybody that's going to DMV lately, you know what I'm talking about. To raise every fee that you that's money that comes out of your pocket. It might not be a tax. The money's got to come from somewhere if we're going to fund transportation. You know, in Northern Virginia, we're talking about the Dulles Toll Road. The Dulles Toll Road, 11-mile stretch of highway, is being told not to pay for the Dulles Toll Road, but to pay for rail between the two airports, National and Dulles, is ultimately what you're going to end up with. One of the most important economic development projects we've got going on in Virginia. Northern Virginia is 28% of the population. They produce 40% of the state's revenue. Do we have an interest in continuing that? Yes, we do. Every one of us does. That's the issue. The Dulles Toll Road is being told to pay for the Dulles train. By 2016, it's estimated that the toll will be $6.75 one way. Wow. Is that a tax? Well, some people might not say it's a tax, but if you're paying it every single day, it's a tax. You got to pay for transportation somehow. Tolls, the gas tax, right? Think about the gas tax. As cars become more efficient, more fuel efficient, the gas tax is going to be an eroding source of revenue. So anybody that thinks we can raise the gas tax and solve the problem, right, you can't do it. Maybe that's a temporary solution. North Carolina, their gas tax, I understand, and I haven't traveled down there lately, but I understand their gas tax is 39.5 cents a gallon, while ours is 17.5 cents a gallon. Well, if you go to Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina, and Covington, Virginia, you're going to pay exactly the same thing retail for gas. even though their gas tax is 22 cents higher than ours. Now that, to me, I mean, something's amok when they can have a higher gas tax and build a superhighway to Wilmington, and we have a lower gas tax and are at the end of our rope on transportation funding. So the money's got to come from somewhere. Does it come through from taxes or tolls or some other idea or gimmick? I don't know. I'm open to suggestions and ideas. But I've been criticized any number of places because I did what I thought was right on a couple occasions and voted to raise the gas tax.
This was sort of alluded to, not in jest totally, I think, but could you respond? Do you think a hypothetical redistricting process would help solve the impasse in this last session of the General Assembly?
From my, and I'm sorry I didn't pick up on that when you were talking about the structural change. From my perspective, and Bryce might disagree, there's nothing we can do more that would be more fundamental to our process than changing the way we draw the district lines. We draw the districts, whether we're Democrats or Republicans. Whether Democrats are drawing the lines or Republicans are drawing the lines, they're drawing districts to elect Democrats or Republicans. You end up, you know, talking only, I try to represent all 200,000 people in the district I represent, but a Republican's gonna have a hard time being elected in this district. That's just the reality. So I only have to talk to the Democratic voters. You know, and that's not fair. That's not fair. In 1971, as a result of redistricting, federal courts threw out the plans in Iowa and redrew the lines. And they changed their constitution, changed the law there. And what Iowa does, now they draw the districts in basically a party-blind status. You can't consider where incumbents live. You can't consider where candidates live. You can't consider past political performance. The only thing you can consider is population. How radical that is. How radical. And you know what? They have close elections. They have competitive elections. Bryce just had a close election. I mean, he's got a different set of circumstances to deal with than I do. But from my perspective, elections should be where a great dialogue of ideas takes place, and you have candidates that end up elected and responsive to all of their constituents. And if you did that, I think you'd end up with a less partisan and more problem-solving focused legislature. And I'm sorry, I missed that. That was a cue in for me, I guess, on this when you talked about structural change. But I think I've introduced since 2002 or 2003 every year, and I got it out of the legislature, whether it was a Republican Senate or out of the Senate, whether it was a Republican Senator or Democratic Senate, I got, you know, would carry these constitutional amendments. This year, Jill Vogel, a Republican State Senator from up in Fauquier County, carried it and got it over to the House, and it died. But if you would turn redistricting into a nonpartisan process, you know, you would, and then whether you elected a Democratic legislature or a Republican legislature, you would elect a problem-solving, focused legislature. And frankly, I think that would solve just about every problem we've got.
As you heard what I represent, then you know that the district that I have has been, for lack of a better term, gerrymandered the tar out of. And honestly, every district that my former opponent ran in 2007 and lost was cut out of my district. So I was telling somebody earlier, I'm only in my district by like five houses. I walk to the end of my street to my stop sign, take a right, and I'm out. And my neighbors in my own neighborhood can't even vote for me. So that's how close it was this year. And Cree's right. You know, I sat in some of those nonpartisan, the Governor's Commission on Redistricting, and listen to a lot smarter people than I am. And it sounds like the reasonable, prudent thing to do. It really does. And you know what? And it's one of those things where you have, on Friday nights, you have two football teams that get together and may the best team win. And I think the Commonwealth would be better for it. I mean, we talked in privileges and elections a few times about some of these things, and wanting to maybe try to fix even the split precincts. I have 9 split precincts in Spotsylvania alone, 4 to 7 in Culpeper, a few here, and voters are confused. They don't know where to go. They're used to going to certain places. That's all changed, and I literally had a house almost cut in half voting-wise, and so it wasn't an easy process, and I think because of some of the for lack of a better term, I'd just say party line votes that we had in privileges and elections, there was no way we were going to get our just trying to clean up split precincts done this year. And I think you'd probably agree with that. There was just no way, and we wanted to, trust me. I know there, Cree and I talked a few times about some of these precincts with people, and you know, it is what it is. It's not a perfect process, but I sure like to see it change.
One thing. One point I want to make with respect to nonpartisan redistricting, we're a Voting Rights Act state. We're a Voting Rights Act state because we have a history of racial discrimination in the voting process.
Yep.
But there is one Voting Rights Act state, Mississippi, that has a nonpartisan process for redistricting. I'm not certain how it works down there, but I know that it can be done. And when I was drawing my bill, I would base it on basically the Iowa process and the New Jersey process. Those were the two that I liked the best, but I'd also tweak the language a little bit to make sure we could address the fact that we are Voting Rights Act state. We have certain criteria that we have to meet. We cannot be just blind to the process and say we're going to just do what Iowa does, because we can't do that. But we can get pretty close.
I'm going to take the liberty and sort of editorialize a few questions here that all seem to surround a similar issue and concern, and that has to do with women's rights. Part of a question is, why is the state of Virginia moving backwards when it comes to women's rights, and is this personhood amendment an invasion of women's rights? And would both of you respond as to whether or not you perceive an issue? Also, there was a question or questions involving other, and I use the word minorities uncomfortably, because women still are considered a minority in some circles. Sexual persuasions, identities, etc., are also falling under the questions that were raised relative to, I would suggest, civil rights, including women's rights.
Something else structurally I didn't talk about. One thing that the Byrd machine, Harry Byrd, did that was smart was create the Virginia Department of Highways. But one thing that wasn't smart, that wasn't good over the long haul, was had state elections one year, federal elections another year. And the premise makes some sense. Focus on federal issues one year, focus on state elections the other year. But because we have elections in Virginia every year, people get fatigued. They don't turn out. And so the only people that turn out at these state elections are the people that are really focused on, driven by certain issues or driven, that might be driven by just a social consciousness or citizenship, but a lot of people don't turn out to vote. And so people who are have certain, what may seem to me or you as radical positions, they're going to turn out because they're going to try to make a difference. I think absolutely we were taking giant steps back this past session. This personhood thing that would define a person as one who is conceived is just would set aside jurisprudence. I mean, it was just radical and far-reaching in terms of Virginia law, and it didn't pass ultimately because the governor got a little nervous about it. He wants to be vice president, and he didn't want all the publicity, and he sent the word down, and the bill died. The other one that didn't die, And as I said, some of these things, gosh, you don't like to talk about them in public. But this whole ultrasound process, here, the law of Virginia, the law of the country since 1973 has been that women have a right to to choose. Women have certain amounts of reproductive freedom, and I believe that. I agree with that. Well, you may disagree. This is in the United States of America, you've got a right to believe or as you choose, and that's all right, and I respect that. But every year, there are efforts to roll back certain elements of Roe v. Wade, certain elements of a right to choose. The ultrasound bill was really an extension of a bill that the governor introduced, I think, when he was in the House of Delegates years ago. They call it a woman's right to know, basically. That you want to assume that a woman who's made the very difficult choice to terminate a pregnancy doesn't know what she's doing. And you need, the ultrasound bill was to force that woman to have an ultrasound and also have a picture taken of the ultrasound and to give that woman an ability to see that picture, for crying out loud. You know, to assume that a woman who makes that very difficult choice at really a tough place in her life, you know, hasn't thought about it, is just an insult to basic human dignity. It was awful. One of the proudest day I had this session was just to see when those bills were being debated, Capitol Square fill up with 800, 1,000, 1,200 people, mostly women, just stand there in solidarity against these bills. They were terrible. But I was just so proud to see people come and to voice their opinion. There's no question we're taking a step back with that bill. The governor, this is interesting thing. And Ralph Northam, you know, Bryce was talking about Ralph Northam being a pediatric neurologist. So he's a doctor. He knows a little bit about kids. He knows a little bit about the way human body works. The bill passed the Senate, passed the House, but it basically got you know, the senator who introduced the bill struck her bill when the word came down from the governor that was, you know, he didn't want these embarrassing bills out there. And the delegate insisted on her bill going forward, and it passed. But it passed in amended form. This was a questioning Ralph Northam made when the bill was being debated. He basically made the point. Over 90% of abortions occur in the first trimester. In the first trimester, to really see anything, because the people who promoted this bill said, you know, you need an ultrasound to know how old the fetus is. Well, for crying out loud, that ought to be between the doctor and the woman. The state's got no interest there. But Dr. Northam on the Senate floor made sure that everybody knew before they voted on that bill that there was a better than 90% chance in the first trimester you weren't going to be able to tell how old that fetus was through the use of a normal ultrasound, external ultrasound, as I like to think about it. You'd have to do an internal ultrasound, which is what got caught the headlines with Rachel Maddow and The Daily Show and some of the other late night shows. They call it the transvaginal ultrasound. And so once that came out and people understood that a doctor was going to be ordered under this law to do a procedure that he or she did not prescribe that involved an invasive procedure on a woman, somebody's wife or daughter or girlfriend was going to have something stuck in her body to perform this ultrasound, everything went nuts. And the governor sent down amendments to basically require the ultrasound be just a normal external ultrasound. Well, the irony of the bill is that there are very few ultrasounds that's actually going to show anything, because in the first trimester, the fetus is not very big. And the ultrasound is ultimately not going to show anything. We went through a huge fight. Ultimately, all it's going to do is add expense to the procedure. And that expense is going to be borne by the person who's undergoing it. It was a step backwards.
I would respond with this this way. Two things, actually a couple of things. The senator that put the bill forward was actually pregnant at the time and had been going through some of these procedures. And let's be real frank, an abortion is a pretty invasive procedure. So if they're going to go through an abortion, then having a transvaginal ultrasound is probably no no cakewalk either. But I think the intent of the bill, quite frankly, was to be able to inform women of what's the process, what they have, and those sorts of things. And the thing that worked its way out after the bill had made it through and some folks did some more homework was Planned Parenthood actually does transvaginal ultrasounds on 90%+ of the patients that they are seeking abortions anyway. So it's already being conducted. And you know, the law of the land right now is Roe versus Wade, and as long as Roe versus Wade is on the books, then we're going to comply with that law. And you know, I'll tell you, when some of these social issues came up, we handed it to the Democrats for them to use as cannon fodder for them not to vote for the budget. And you know, they did a great job at beating the Republicans down with that. And until we got them off the books or out of the committees, we are going to have to endure the lashings of 800 some odd people showing up and all these things blowing up in the media. But the reality is the social bills that came through the General Assembly this year were less than probably 2% of the overall bills that we processed this year. And, you know, as much as I'd like to have been able to focus on the main issue being the main issue, which is taking care of Virginians, it became political football, plain and clear. That's what it became. And it got dragged through the mud and outside and all over the place and in the media. And I can tell you, I wasn't real thrilled to have to be able to walk the gauntlet and have people yell at me and all kinds of things and call me everything under the sun. But, hey, that's what you hired me to do, so I'll take it. But I will tell you, we had some pretty rough testimony. I wasn't in education and health. I don't serve on it. But anytime you're talking about a life issue and these sorts of things, you're going to have people that are passionate on both sides of the aisle. And as much as I'd like to say we could just focus on those things that matter most, transportation, education, how to create jobs and the economy, we're going to have colleagues from the House and from the Senate that are going to be putting bills forward that are going to do those sorts of things and bring out those sorts of passions. And you know, we get through it the best we can. So I don't think it was a huge step backwards for women or anything like that. And I'm not trying to make it a big political issue. It is what it is. And, you know, some people believe that life begins at conception. I personally do. I've spent my entire life protecting life, from being an Army Ranger and serving my country to being a police officer and a SWAT guy. And, you know, I've always been there to protect people and property. And I'll continue to vote in that direction, whether or not we agree or disagree. The one thing I can tell you is that my personal opinion as a father is I think every child, every life has an enormous capacity for greatness. And I believe in life. So.
Thank you. One last question. What legislative proposals have you or your party caucus considered from the American Legislative Exchange Council, known as the ALEC, and could you explain exactly what they do?
What is that?
ALEC. I'm not a member of ALEC. I've never introduced any legislation. And Bryce is a first year guy, so he might not, you know, he asked me what they were, and I, you know, honestly, he probably hadn't even had the opportunity to decide whether he's going to be a member or not. I don't know. There's several national organizations for legislators. National Conference of State Legislators is kind of the umbrella that all legislatures basically join and send groups to. In the 70s, a group called the American Legislative Exchange Council was created, and that's a different. That's also a group of legislators from around the country, but there are also some private sector groups that fund ALEC. I don't know. I've never been a member. I've never been to a meeting. I've never introduced any legislation they proposed. I don't have any dog in that fight, so to speak.
I don't know what it is. I know I just got appointed by Senator Stosch to the SLC, the Southern Legislative Conference, for energy and environment. And then I am a member of NCSL, and I got appointed as the appoint person for military and veterans affairs. So I actually get to go out next week to and NCSL is a bipartisan think tank of state legislators to address some of these more common issues like land use issues next to military installations and those sorts of things. So I'm hoping to be able to come back as an informed legislator to inform Cree and my colleagues of what are some of the challenges that we're facing with our DOD establishments and stuff, which is near and dear to my heart. I just took an assignment from leadership to be the co-chair with Rich Anderson for the Military Caucus. So I'm excited about the appointment. So I don't know what the other is, to be honest with you.
Okay, anything you gentlemen would like to say in closing?
Thanks for your attention. Thanks for having me over here. And please, you know, I've just got an office down 300 Preston. If I can be of service to you, my number is 296-5491. Give me a call.
I just want to say thanks. And please, if you get the opportunity, come down to see us. Career and myself will make sure you guys get a full tour and bring you up to speed on where we are. We love to see people from home. We see enough lobbyists and of each other to last the 60 days. So love to see you guys come. Thank you for the opportunity to serve you. And it's just been an honor and privilege for us and our families. So thank you very much.
And thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.